The search for extraterrestrial intelligence is a lonely corner of science.
Worldwide, the total number of people doing this for a job, if you will, it's maybe a dozen, maybe 15, something like that.
Seth Shostak is the director of the Center for SETI Research at the SETI Institute. It's an unassuming office building in the heart of Silicon Valley. Many of the researchers work from home or only come in once or twice a week. There are lots of empty cubicles.
There's actually not much to see here, so let's walk this way. This is
when the Institute was founded in 1984, its purpose was to look for intelligent life.
You know, using antennas to try and eavesdrop.
But since then, they've expanded into astrobiology research as well.
So could there have been life on Mars? Is there maybe life on Mars today? The moons of the outer solar system, how did life get started? Things like that.
Today, most of the researchers here are astrobiologists, funded by outside grants. In fact, only six people at the Institute are looking for intelligence, the eye in SETI. Shostak leads that small team, and he says they've come a long way since the first experiment in 1960.
Instead of having a single antenna listening to one spot on the radio dial at a time, now we can have multiple antennas listening to millions of spots on the dial at the same time.
They use the Allen Telescope Array, a sprawling field of 42 antennas in Northern California. And if the technology keeps improving, Shostak expects to make contact by about 2040. But so far, nothing. Which begs the question, where is everybody?
The Fermi paradox is an idea that was floated by Enrico Fermi, the famous physicist, back in 1950 at Los Alamos Lab.
Fermi was working on the Manhattan Project at the time. He figured if intelligent life is out there, someone probably would have colonized us by now.
We should see aliens everywhere, and we don't seem to.
The Fermi paradox has led some to conclude that life is probably rare in the universe. But Shostak doesn't buy it. In recent years, he says, NASA's Kepler Space Telescope has surveyed thousands of star systems in the Milky Way, and about one in five of those stars is orbited by an Earth-like planet.
That means there are tens of billions of Earth-like worlds in the galaxy. It's a big number.
So the odds seem pretty good that there's some life out there. Besides, if we're totally alone, that could mean only one thing.
This place is a miracle. And as a scientist, it's very difficult to believe in miracles, because normally, if you're believing in miracles, you're only fooling yourself. Most things aren't miracles.
Our planet is not a miracle, but our planet may have been lucky.
That's Don Brownlee.
I'm a professor of astronomy. I'm also the co-author of the book Rare Earth.
Brownlee wrote the book with paleontologist Peter Ward. They argue that microbial life may be common in the universe, but complex life, the kind we have on Earth, is, well, rare.
There are a number of nice things that the Earth has that's promoted the evolution of higher organisms.
Things like environmental stability. We have plate tectonics that recycle carbon, acting like a thermostat to keep Earth livable.
Also, Jupiter, interestingly enough, plays a role.
It's possible that Jupiter has steered asteroids in Earth's direction over time, and without those asteroids, we wouldn't have water. The point is, these and other factors, happy accidents kind of, have made life on Earth possible. And our planet seems to be the exception, not the rule.
The universe is actually quite hostile to life. It's either too hot or too cold, or there's not enough pressure, or there's no water.
Some say the rare Earth hypothesis relies on a limited definition of life, that it doesn't take into account alien worlds with life forms we can't even imagine.
We can speculate about, you know, silicon-based life and so forth, so life that might live in liquid helium or molten lead. But, we have no physical basis for that.
Brownlee says our theories should be based on the data we have, which is why he actually thinks SETI is important, because it's looking for data where no one else is.
I don't think it should be a national priority, but, you know, I mean, it's certainly a good thing to do.
Back at the Institute, Shostak says SETI is far from a national priority. They used to be funded by NASA, but in 1993, when the government's top priority was dealing with the deficit, the search for ET was an easy target. SETI's biggest opponent was Richard Bryan, a senator from Nevada.
The amendment I am offering today will eliminate funding for what I believe to be a foolish and wasteful NASA program.
They lost government funding, and today
the money that funds our SETI research is due to people who just send us a check because they think this is an interesting thing to do.
Wow, kind of like public radio.
It is like public radio, yes, but without the pledge drives.
The biggest donors have always been their neighbors in Silicon Valley. The founders of Intel, Microsoft, and Hewlett-Packard have all given money. Still, Shostak and the team struggle to bring in just $1 or $2 million a year, the bare minimum they need. But even on a shoestring budget, one researcher is planning way, way ahead. His name is Doug Vakoch, and he has maybe the coolest job ever.
I'm the director of interstellar message composition at the SETI Institute.
His job is to figure out what to say to extraterrestrials if we ever communicate. And Vakoch hopes we will. After years of just listening, he thinks it's time to amp up the search and send a message of our own. This idea is called Active SETI, and some scientists think it's a really bad idea.
No less a person than Stephen Hawking has said, whatever you do, don't transmit to the extraterrestrials. They may come and strip mine our planet.
Those who oppose Active SETI say we don't know what's out there, so we shouldn't advertise ourselves. But to Vakoch, that fear doesn't make sense.
Even if another civilization can travel between the stars, if they're hostile, if they want to come here and eat us or simply destroy us, sad news is, it's too late.
Earth has been leaking radio and television transmissions into space for decades. If anyone's out there listening, they've probably already heard us. So Vakoch figures we might as well send a proper greeting.
Lucy, I'm home!
When we think about how to communicate with another civilization, we can't count on them knowing English or Swahili or Russian, so we have to come up with something universal.
And if they're receiving our message at all, that means they can build a radio telescope. That means they're engineers. They understand math and physics.
They probably know at least 2 plus 2 equals 4, so that's a starting point.
And from there, Vakoch says we might be able to tell them about something as abstract as altruism, say, using the language of genetics.
Or consider music. Music captures something quintessential about what it is to be human. But if you think about it, the structure of music is very much a mathematical and physical thing. So once we can communicate something about mathematical ratios and notions of time and frequency and duration, we can start describing our music.
It'll be a difficult task, expressing human experience in truly universal terms. But even if we never make contact, thinking about what we might say is a worthwhile pursuit.
The reality is, there may be no extraterrestrials out there. You know, I hope to God there are. But if, at the end of the day, the only thing we have accomplished is learning more about ourselves by trying to make contact, the whole project will still have been worth it.
For now, SETI won't be sending any messages into space. But as long as they have the money, they'll keep doing what they've always done, exploring the universe through the radio dial, listening for signs of life. For The Pulse, I'm Stephen Jackson.